Thank you, Brother Frank. You know, sometimes, brethren, you think that speakers don't get nervous, but I'll tell you, as I was coming up on the stage, I accidentally walked into the women's bathroom instead of... And as soon as I saw the pink walls, I knew I was in the wrong place. So now that I've got that out of my system, we can begin. Well, it's good to be with you. It's been a wonderful convention. I'm glad to have my family with me, too. I think we all look at the scriptures and we search for examples of some of the things that we're supposed to be. We like living, breathing examples because we can relate to those better than we can to theoretical ones. Well, one of them that we come across is an especially moving example of what we should be is the story of David and Jonathan. In their friendship, we see many, many qualities that we would all do well to study and focus on and to try to practice in our own relationships with one another. In their lives together, we see trust, loyalty, kindness, sympathy, understanding, and both filial and agape love. One definition for agape love that was given recently that appeals to me very much is that agape seeks the eternal interest of the other person. It's considered the highest form of love because someone with agape love can do loving acts without requiring that love be returned. It's a love that does not seek self-interest. And Jonathan was an especially good example of this. Filial love, on the other hand, is a love that family members have for each other. It's a love that is reciprocated. Vine's Dictionary defines filial as tender affection. I like that. The scriptural admonition regarding filial love is found in Romans 12:10. Reading it from the Diaglot, Paul writes, "With brotherly kindness towards each other, be tenderly affectionate, in honor preferring one another." Well, in their friendship, Jonathan and David had a wonderful combination of filial and agape love. They had a tender affection for one another as well as a selfless, self-sacrificing love. It was an amazing friendship. And maybe the reason the Lord showed it to us was because of how complete and well-balanced it really was. You know, even though they were two men, in some ways their relationship can be a pattern even for marriage. Marriage should be a friendship. It should have tender affection and sacrificial love. Trust and loyalty and kindness and sympathy should all be common elements in a marriage relationship. And if they're not, we shouldn't be satisfied with accepting a poor condition, but we should try to revitalize our relationships and our marriages and be reinvigorated and inspired by stories like this. When we see what the Lord can really do when two people are both consecrated to do His will. As we explore the friendship, we see that the circumstances of life tested their friendship beyond what most friendships could endure. But the reason it endured was because they never allowed these outside pressures to drive them apart, even when the pressure was from Saul, Jonathan's own father, the powerful king of Israel. Jonathan would not betray David. In fact, he actively looked for ways of blessing and helping his friend. Jonathan sometimes walked a fine line of balancing his loyalties because it's clear from Scripture that he had the same kind of love for his father. But Jonathan was able to see that Saul's hatred for David was based on jealousy. And because of that, Jonathan would not allow his love for David to be compromised. Brethren, there is a lot that we can learn about friendship, about what it means to be brethren, and even how we can become better husbands and wives by looking at the relationship between these two men. As we look at their lives, we're going to take a side trip, and we're going to see that the Lord may have intended their relationship to be a picture of the spiritual relationship between the ancient worthies and the church class. This is what Brother Russell says on reprint 1908. He writes, "The friendship of Jonathan and David seems to be suggestive of that beautiful accord which shall exist between the glorified church and earthly princes who shall be next to them in the kingdom of God. There will not be a note of discord or rivalry or jealousy between them, for each will be delighted to fill his honored place in the wonderful plan of God and will love the other as his own soul. David then represents the church class, while Jonathan represents the ancient worthies. You know, in spite of the fact that we've lived in different ages and none of us have met an ancient worthy, we still feel a special kinship to them, don't we? As part of this picture of kinship, we're going to read in 1 Samuel about three covenants that Jonathan and David made between themselves, which detail our relationship with the ancient worthies and the heritage that they have passed on to us. In many ways, the ancient worthies are the spiritual forerunners of the church. They fought their spiritual battles before we did, and you might say they paved the road of sacrifice on which others would someday follow. Let's begin our study by looking at the life of Jonathan. We're told that he was the oldest son of King Saul. We're introduced to him in 1 Samuel 13:2, where he was leading a force of 1,000 men against the Philistines. Now, biblical scholars believe that Jonathan was about 30 years old at this point. Being the eldest son of King Saul, he was the apparent heir to the throne of Israel. He was a natural leader, and because of that, his men had a profound respect for him. He had great faith in the Lord, and that gave him courage in his battles. He seemed to understand that true courage comes in knowing that there's a higher power supporting you. He knew that success on the battlefield came when the Lord was obeyed and trusted. And certainly those lessons carry over to us as well. We can have courage in any situation in life when we believe, we really believe, that the Lord is behind us and is overruling every experience in our life. After the death of Saul and Jonathan, David wrote a eulogy to them. It's found in 2 Samuel 1, verses 17 through 27. Let me read verse 23. This is from the Rotherham. David writes, "Saul and Jonathan, delightfully loving in their lives, even in their death were not divided. Beyond eagles were they swift, beyond lions were they strong." Well, it seems clear that Jonathan had a wonderful ability to love others. He was delightfully loving with his father and his father with him. You know, we sometimes remember only Saul's unfaithfulness to God and his bitter jealousy of David. But apparently he was a good father, and he developed a very close relationship with his eldest son. One of the marvelous memories that we have of Jonathan is that he did not end his relationship with Saul once Saul became very proud. He didn't stop loving his father when Saul sinned. Even when his father raged with anger over Jonathan's defense of David and threw a spear at Jonathan, he remained loyal to Saul. Not many men would do that. But Jonathan was able to separate the sin from the sinner and keep loving the sinner while hating the sin. Brethren, if we could all do that better, I know that our relationships with one another and with everyone would improve. Even though Saul had sinned and done wrong, Jonathan stuck with him in every battle, and it's because of that that they were killed together in battle, along with Jonathan's two younger brothers. And so David says that even in death, they were not divided. David goes on and says in verse 26, "I am distressed for thee, my brother Jonathan, delightful to me exceedingly. Wonderful was thy love to me, passing the love of women." Yes, Jonathan was David's spiritual brother, who brought delight to David's heart. He gave his love freely. And because of that, Jonathan seems to have been a very wonderful, easy person for others to love. And I think that he would have been a very good king of Israel had God chosen him. Looking at the beginning of their friendship, it appears that Jonathan first met David just after David slew Goliath. Let's go back and read 1 Samuel 18:1 through 4. "And it came to pass, when he had made an end of speaking unto Saul, that the soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And Saul took him that day and would let him go no more to his father's house." Then Jonathan and David made a covenant because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was upon him and gave it to David and his garments, even to his sword and to his bow and to his girdle. I love that statement. The soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Brethren, here is the uniting of filial and agape love. Jonathan saw a brother in David. He saw a man with the same devotion to the Lord. In the past, Jonathan had been very brave in the battles against the Philistines, but this time he stood quietly as Goliath taunted Israel. For some reason, he couldn't seem to muster the same strength against the one man, Goliath, as he had against an army of Philistines. With the rest of Israel's army, Jonathan just listened as Goliath taunted them for 40 days. Listen to what Goliath said. He cried, "I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we might fight together." When Saul and all Israel heard those words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Saul and Jonathan were afraid of Goliath. But when Jonathan heard the words of David and saw him go out alone against the giant and then strike him dead with his sling, Jonathan knew that here was a young man of great faith. What caused Jonathan to fear and remain quiet made David's heart burn within him and fearlessly go out into that field against this giant to defend the Lord's name and the Lord's people. Well, scholars believe that Jonathan may have been about 10 years older than David at this time. So as we said, if Jonathan was 30, then David may have been about 20 during all this experience. It was a genuine thrill for Jonathan to see a younger man of such faith. We read that David's experiences, his faith, was born out of previous experiences. In fact, before fighting Goliath, he had to convince Saul to let him go. And he told him that he had slain a lion and a bear in defense of his father's sheep. And he reasoned that if the Lord had delivered him from those wild beasts, then certainly he would also deliver him from Goliath. Notice the progression in David's battle. He says he was delivered from a lion and then a bear. And now it was logical that God would deliver him from an awesome giant. I think that's a picture of how faith grows. When you're young in the faith, you just begin to see the small overrulings of the Lord in your life. As you grow, those overrulings become clearer and more pronounced and easier to spot, even if the experiences and trials become harder. As time goes on, we begin to see the reality that God actually is in control of our lives and that nothing happens to us that is not for our good. After seeing how God helps us slay our lions and bears, we do find it easier to trust him based on those previous experiences. Brethren, as David learned to trust God, may we all learn that when we face our own personal Goliaths, we really have nothing to fear from them. It was God who guided that stone to the forehead of Goliath. But you know, David had to sling it first. And so there are two parts of faith: our believing, our acting on our beliefs, and God's following through and directing the issues of our life. Jonathan's faith seemed to have faltered somewhat when it came to Goliath, but David never wavered. Later, we're going to see that the opposite is true. Jonathan was the one to encourage David. Brethren, isn't that what fellowship is all about? When one of us is weak in something, we can gain strength from the faith of another. That is one of the main reasons the Lord tells us not to forsake the assembling of ourselves together, so that we can all draw strength from one another. Jonathan and David were very similar in character. They were both humble, honest, courageous, and faithful men. When you have those types of things in common, there is a natural bond that forms. On reprint 32:32, Brother Russell says that those who would be the best of friends need a third object in which both are interested, and that like the radius of a circle, the nearer they come to the center, the nearer they approach one another. Well, that illustration fits Jonathan and David to a T. We read in 1 Samuel 18, 3 and 4 that Jonathan and David made a covenant with one another. It was Jonathan who prompted this. To seal the covenant, Jonathan took off his robe, his armor, his sword, his girdle, and his famous bow and arrow, and he gave them to David. Why did Jonathan do that? Of what significance were these items to Jonathan? Well, as a soldier, they were probably the most important things in his life. He lived by those things. To Jonathan, they represented the honor and power of Israel. To give them to David shows that he considered David an equal, one who deserved to represent Israel. In fact, it really is an admission that David was a greater warrior than himself. Brethren, that is remarkable, because at this point, Jonathan was the prince of Israel, and David was an unknown shepherd boy. What a recognition by one in authority and power. David now had two sets of armor. In 1 Samuel 17:54, we're told that after he had killed Goliath, he took Goliath's armor and put it in his tent. It doesn't tell us why he did that, but it seems reasonable that he wanted it as a remembrance of that great victory of faith. That was an Ebenezer for him, to be sure. Now David received Jonathan's armor. That too became a remembrance for David of another victory. A victory where David won the heart, won the friendship of Jonathan. It became also a token of the covenant that they made between themselves. Well, in order to understand just what this first covenant was between Jonathan and David, we need to skip to a future time in their lives, because later, David makes a comment in referring back to the first covenant, and it gives us a little more information. It's found in 1 Samuel 20, verse 8. David, in this context, was despondent over Saul's desire to kill him. And he speaks to Jonathan, and this is what he says. He says, "Therefore thou shalt deal kindly with thy servant, for thou hast brought thy servant into a covenant of the Lord with thee." Notice how David reveals that it was Jonathan's idea to make a covenant. Rotherham puts it this way, "Into a covenant of Yahweh hast thou brought thy servant with thee." It was a covenant between Jonathan and David on the one hand and God on the other hand. The first covenant was that they would help each other to be faithful to the Lord. Jonathan knew that faith needed to be supported. He had just experienced the strengthening of his own faith by David, and now he was able to see the importance of a brotherhood of faith. What a support they became for one another. What a picture of brotherhood they provide for anyone who wants to be faithful to the Lord. The lesson we see here is that none of us can walk the narrow way alone. We need the love and support of others who are fighting the same spiritual battles, because only they will understand what we're going through. We've all made a covenant of sacrifice to the Lord. So like Jonathan and David, we should all be on the same side, urging each other on, supporting one another in our weaknesses, and reminding one another of how to walk this narrow way. That was the first covenant, a covenant of brotherhood. Jonathan gave David his armor as a token of that covenant. Now there's another possibility regarding this first covenant in connection with the clothing and armor that Jonathan gave to David, and it gives more specific application to what was done by Jonathan. There are a number of other biblical instances where a transfer of clothing was significant. For example, in Numbers, the 20th chapter, Aaron was not allowed to enter the Promised Land as a punishment for his rebellion at the waters of Meribah. God told Moses to strip Aaron of his clothing and put it on his son, Eleazar. The word "strip" there is the same word used when Jonathan stripped himself of his robe and gave it to David. It shows a transfer of office from an unacceptable man to one chosen by the Lord. Another example of the symbolic use of clothing is found in 1 Kings 11. There we see the prophet Ahijah tear his clothing into 12 pieces. He then gives 10 of the pieces to Jeroboam to indicate that the kingdom of Solomon would be subsequently divided into 10 in two tribes, and that Jeroboam would receive authority over the 10. The clothing then was a symbol of the nation. The tearing of the clothing was a symbol of how the nation would be torn apart after the death of Solomon. Another example of the significance of clothing was when Elijah cast his mantle on Elisha as a signal of the transfer of the prophetic office from one prophet to another. There's one more non-biblical example of clothing being significant. In 1929, French archaeologists found a huge cache of clay tablets in an ancient seaport city called Ugarit. These tablets date back to the 14th and 13th century BC, a short time before our story of Jonathan and David. Ugarit is in present-day Syria, north of Israel. Well, one particular tablet is of interest to us as we examine our story. The tablet tells of a divorce between a 13th century king and his wife. And as is common in all divorces, one of the questions that had to be dealt with in their separation was what would be done with their son. The queen was allowed to return to her own country, but the son had to make a choice. The key passage of interest says the following. Yutisharuma is prince in Ugarit. If Yutisharuma says, I will go after my mother, let him place his garment on the throne and let him go. Amistramru, king of Ugarit, shall establish another of his sons in Ugarit as prince. Well, isn't it interesting that by placing his garment on the throne, the prince was indicating his decision to give up claim to that throne? It's similar to the usage of clothing that we see in the biblical accounts. If Jonathan was following this custom, then he was giving up his claim to the throne of Israel in favor of God's anointed, David. If that was the case, then the first covenant was their devotion to making the transfer of power from Saul to David become a reality. Either way you look at it, whether it was a covenant of helping each other be faithful, or it was an agreement that they would allow the transfer of power to be accomplished, the point is the same. They were convicted together to do the Lord's will, no matter what it cost either one of them. It really was a brotherhood of faith to do the Lord's will. Is there an antitypical application to all this? Well, we can't be sure. But if the Lord intended the passing of the armor from Jonathan to David to be symbolic of something greater, it certainly isn't difficult to see what it could mean. We know about our armor, don't we? Paul writes about it in Ephesians, the 6th chapter. He describes a new creature's armor as truth, justification, peace, faith, hope, and the word of God is a sword. The fact that Jonathan was older and he was a warrior for Israel before David shows that the ancient worthies were in spiritual battles long before the church. Paul reflects on their influence in our lives. When he talks about the ancient worthies, he says in Hebrews 12:1, wherefore, seeing we are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, the ancient worthies, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. Brethren, how many times have each of us examined their armor and just marveled at their faith? How many times have we looked at how their hope inspired them and kept them going against seemingly insurmountable obstacles? They stood as an example of how to trust in the Lord's providence no matter how difficult the circumstances of life could become. Their examples of having peace in terrifying situations is really one of their legacies to us. And they wielded the word of the Lord as a weapon against sin and error. In so many ways, their lives were mere images of the struggles of the new creation. Every time we study them, every time we gain inspiration from them, we are antitypically accepting the armor that David received from Jonathan. In 1 Samuel, the 20th chapter, we have the making of the second covenant between Jonathan and David. It's an extraordinarily moving and emotional story. I wish we had time to read the whole chapter. Let's just read a few sections and try to get the feeling of what was happening. Saul had become extremely jealous of David's popularity. In verse 1, hiding from the wrath of Saul, David flees to Jonathan. And he says to Jonathan, what have I done? What is mine iniquity? And what is my sin before thy Father that he seeketh my life? Jonathan tries to reassure him that because of his own close relationship with his father, that his father wouldn't do anything without telling him first. But David responds by saying, no, your father knows how close we are. He wouldn't tell you because he wouldn't want you to be grieved. David then laments in verse 3 and says, as surely as the Lord liveth, there is but a step between me and death. Jonathan's tender answer to that is in verse 4. He says, whatever your soul desireth, I will even do it for you. Well, David wanted to know whether Saul planned to kill him, and so he devised a test. He told Jonathan that he would not eat at Saul's table for the next 3 days. If Saul asked for him, Jonathan was to say that David had gone to Bethlehem for a yearly celebration. The test was in seeing how Saul would react to David's absence. If Saul wasn't bothered by David being away, then it would be a sign that David was safe. But if Saul became angry, then Jonathan would know that David's life really was in danger. And of course, that was the reaction. Jonathan agreed to the test, and he learned that Saul was intent on killing David when he became enraged and threw a spear at Jonathan. And so Jonathan returned to David to warn him to flee the land. And in their discussion, we see the second covenant made between them. It's found in 1 Samuel 20, verses 14 to 17. This is now Jonathan speaking to David. He says, and thou shalt not only while yet I live show me the kindness of the Lord that I die not, but also thou shalt not cut off thy kindness from my house forever. No, not when the Lord hath cut off the enemies of David, every one from the face of the earth. So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, let the Lord even require it at the hands of David's enemies. And Jonathan caused David to swear again because he loved him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. What's interesting that Jonathan should say these things here at this point when David was depressed and fearful of Saul. He was showing David that this experience would pass. And to show that he believed it, he spoke of the time that David would be king, and he even asked David to make a covenant that he would remember his house and bless his family. That was an extremely unusual request. Two men who under any other circumstances might have been rivals for the throne of Israel are here making a covenant that the young newcomer would bless the seed of the current heir apparent. David never hesitated to accept the covenant of blessing the house of Jonathan because he deeply appreciated the love and devotion of his dear friend, and he saw how rare he really was. He saw that Jonathan believed in God's choice for the next king of Israel. Antitypically, this corresponds to God's plan of having the younger bless the older. Remember the text in Psalms 45:16. It talks about this. It says, instead of thy fathers shall be thy children, whom thou mayst make princes in all the earth. Just as the older Jonathan sought the blessing of David, so the ancient worthies will seek the blessings of the church. It's a spiritual role reversal, just like we see in Psalms. The father is becoming the children, and in turn being blessed by being made princes in all the earth. After the death of Jonathan, David actively sought out family that may have been left of Jonathan. In 2 Samuel 4:4, we're told that Jonathan had a son named Mephibosheth. And David was true to his covenant. Once he found Mephibosheth, he brought him into his palace. He took care of him for the rest of his life. And Mephibosheth really became a son of David. There's a simple lesson in David's integrity. You know, he didn't have to do what he promised to do for Jonathan. Jonathan was gone. He would have never known. But here we see the integrity of David in keeping his word. And the simple lesson for all of us is the importance of being true to our word. Being true to our word to our friends and our brethren is an indication of our love and our respect for them. Brother Russell comments on the Second Covenant in reprint 1908. He says, though the gospel church will receive the first place of favor offered in the Abrahamic covenant, and the ancient worthies will find themselves next in honor, they will rejoice to have it so, because divine wisdom and love have so planned it. as David remembered his covenant with Jonathan, not to cut off his kindness from the house of Jonathan, so the glorified church will remember its covenant to bless the ancient worthies first, and then all the families of the earth who will be under their jurisdiction. Their loving ministry shall be held in everlasting remembrance. Someday, when the ancient worthies are brought back from the dead, the church will feel honored to bless those that have been such an inspiration to them. Jonathan was a natural heir to the throne of Israel. But because of the unfaithfulness of his father, that honor was given to David. Jonathan never resented that, because he saw the rightness of God's decision and he saw the goodness in his friend David. What a character lesson Jonathan left for us. No jealousy or desire to put David's honor down so that he could be elevated. You know, there's a French proverb that says, "There is something in the misfortunes of our best friends that is not wholly displeasing to our secret hearts." Oh, I quivered when I read that. In our fallen human natures, there may be times when there is some truth to that proverb. But in Jonathan, there was never the slightest hint of it. He truly rejoiced that his friend was being elevated by God. Brethren, that is a living example of what Paul meant when he said, "In honor preferring one another." Not just saying it because it's the right thing to say, but really feeling it in your heart. Have you ever felt the slightest bit of jealousy when one of your brethren is praised? Or when something good happens to them, and you know that your gut reaction really is, "Why can't something like that happen to me?" I've felt that way. If you ever have that experience, remember the legacy of unselfish love that Jonathan left for us. David received the throne of Israel instead of Jonathan. And it is thrilling to see that Jonathan was truly glad for David. When we talk about the antitypical application of the ancient worthies playing a secondary role to the church, as Jonathan did to David, we think of Hebrews 11, 39 and 40. It says, "And these all, having attained a good report through faith, received not the promise, God having provided some better thing for us, that they without us should not be made perfect." Well, if Jonathan pictures the ancient worthies, then it would seem reasonable that his son Mephibosheth pictures the nation of Israel. Being only 5 years old at the death of Jonathan shows Israel's spiritual immaturity and the limited influence of the ancient worthies. When the news came of the death of Saul and Jonathan, his nurse fled with him, and in her haste she fell, crippling Mephibosheth in both feet. Well, you wonder why she ran, but apparently the custom back then was that when a new king came to the throne who was not of the same lineage as the previous king, that the entire family of the previous king was slain. As repulsive as that might be to us, there is a logical reason for it. It was to prevent any of the children of the previous king from creating a rebellion against the new king. Well, this nurse pictures, we believe, the false teachers of Israel, like the scribes and the Pharisees, who caused spiritual lameness in Israel. The name Mephibosheth means one who disperses shame. Because of its immaturity and spiritual lameness, the nation of Israel has dispersed shame. It's brought shame to itself. But in 2 Samuel 9:7, this is what David said to Mephibosheth. He said, "Fear not, for I will surely show thee kindness for Jonathan thy father's sake, and will restore thee all the land of Saul thy father, and thou shalt eat bread at my table continually." Well, David's attitude towards the son of Jonathan was exactly what the church's attitude towards the nation of Israel should be. We often quote Romans 11, 28. "As concerning the gospel, they are enemies for your sakes, but as touching the election, they are beloved for the Father's sakes." It's even the same phraseology that David used. In his dealing with Mephibosheth, David restored all the land that his grandfather Saul possessed. He even provided servants to till and harvest the land for the benefit of Mephibosheth. Those actions, we believe, are a picture of Israel's restoration to the promised land, much of the land which they haven't even received yet. The last time that Jonathan and David saw each other is given in 1 Samuel 23, verses 16 through 18. And it's here that the third covenant is made between them. It reads, "And Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David in the wood and strengthened his hand in God. And he said unto him, Fear not, for the hand of Saul my father shall not find thee, and thou shalt be king over Israel, and I shall be next unto thee, and that also Saul my father knoweth. And they two made a covenant before the Lord, and David abode in the wood, and Jonathan went to his house." Brethren, here is filial and agape love of Jonathan shown once again. He encouraged David with the promises of God. He pointed them to him, that he truly was the anointed king. He assured him that even though Saul was king of Israel, he did not have the power to kill David. The third covenant was that once David became king, Jonathan would be next under him. Brethren, that's one covenant that David was not able to keep, because Jonathan was killed before David was crowned. But he certainly would have made Jonathan second in command had the Lord not permitted Jonathan's death. And I think that in a very literal way, Jonathan and David will be right next to each other in the kingdom arrangement. I believe that someday David will yet have the opportunity of fulfilling his covenant with Jonathan. In this interchange between Jonathan and David, we see some underlying principles of friendship that should be a part of our friendships and our fellowship together. There was a genuine sensitivity in Jonathan. He knew how David was feeling, and he made the effort to encourage him with the promises of God. He defended David, even before Saul, and he assured him that no enemy could overcome him. That same sensitivity that we see here should be in each of us as we watch out for the brethren, as we encourage them when they're discouraged, as we stand up for them when they're being treated badly or evil spoken of. Brethren, we have a great tool that we can use in encouraging one another. It's a tool of God's promise that someday we will each be part of the antitypical David, when we will take part in getting rid of all the enemies of the world, just as David went on to do for the nation of Israel. When we see things in the larger context of God's plan, we can take courage and rejoice, even during our difficult experiences. We can feel a sense of joy and belonging when we see that there really are brethren who care about us. That's what family is all about, and that's how God wants us to treat one another. In verse 23, Jonathan reaffirms his conviction to David. He says, "As touching the matter which thou and I have spoken of, behold, the Lord be between thee and me forever." That's our same common bond, isn't it? The Lord is between us, and he will be there forever. So this life on this side of the veil is only the beginning of where the Lord is taking us all as a body. In the story of Jonathan and David, we see a beautiful oneness. We see a unity of spirit that we would all do well to copy. Wouldn't you all like a friend like Jonathan or David? They were always there for each other. They supported and encouraged each other. They pointed one another to the promises of God. They didn't look for faults in one another. Jonathan was like an older brother to David, but a brother who felt no sibling rivalry. One who was just as happy when David was blessed, even if it cost him something. Can you picture the time when the world will be full of that type of spirit? When every person will have a bond of unity like that? Only God can create that type of heart. Brethren, we have all tasted of that on this side of the veil. How sweet it will be when every heart will be full of trust and loyalty and kindness and sympathy, understanding, and love. Let us each be determined to overcome the flesh, because it wants to do the opposite and grow as part of that brotherhood.